This is Sierra Dahl with Municipal Sustainability and Energy Forum, and we have a couple people today who are on the call talking about energy efficiency, Larry Mayer and Catherine Johnson. Larry is working with training realtors, lenders, appraisers, and everybody involved in valuing energy efficiency in buildings, and has done an excellent job of putting together some training programs that are really important. And Catherine has been evaluating energy efficiency programs with utilities for many years, utility states. So, Larry, why don't you go ahead and start out with a discussion on what you're doing.
Okay. I'm an energy engineer up in Fargo, North Dakota, pretty much working the upper Midwest area, background commercial performance contracting energy projects with Honeywell for many years. What I'm doing now is we've realized that just having a good high-performance home that's affordable isn't enough. We found that the realtors don't understand what is unique about a high-performance home, and so they unwittingly just derate them down to a minimum code house because they want to quick get them sold. We also find that the appraisers have no training, and they tend to be nonprofit organizations that are a group of appraisers in a region or a state level, and they have no internal funding to do any forward training such as high-performance home valuations. And then we also find that the underwriters within the bankers have never had any training, and they typically, without training, will default and treat the house just like a minimum code, low-income type house. Then we, in that process, we have worked with the builders, teaching them that they need to provide proper documentation on what goes into that house and have pre-appraisal done on the house and a pre-energy assessment on the house and put that all together. And we found that in approaching each of these professional groups, the builders, the realtors, the appraisers, the lending underwriters, individually, it was hard to get much movement. So then I took a different tact and decided, well, what if we could get a majority of them in a room together, three to four different professional groups in together, and put together a joint training. And so we offered our first class in October of 2016. We offered it in three different time slots, so we repeated it three times over the course of 2 days. We had a lot of excitement in the room because there were utility people in the room, there were bankers in the room, appraisers, realtors, builders, and the questions they were asking and the reflection off of a realtor's question by a builder would say, well, why do you need to know that? Or the appraiser would ask a question, and the banker would go, why do you need to know that? And nobody had talked to each other. And so we said, okay, wow, that's pretty exciting, the energy in the room. So we held a second round of classes in the following spring, and we ended up with about 110 people there. And people were really, really getting motivated. Now, this first round of classes was purposely intended to be a 10,000-foot look at where the industry is at, both at the financial, government, policy level, as well as at the building science and economic side. So then we scheduled to put on a second round of classes in the fall of 2017. And so we offered a more in-depth look of what does that builder need to put together in documentation? What will it look like? How will the realtor work with this information? How will the realtor work with the builder to put together a green addendum, which is an attachment to the appraiser's report? We had a pretty good response by those who were in attendance. But we didn't have the numbers that we wanted, so we held the classes again in the spring, and we had much more attendance coming in. And all along through this process, we were also sponsoring eight-hour classes for appraisers. Appraisers tend to be extremely risk-averse, and they are not forward-thinking as far as learning something new unless it's a completely established thing within the industry. And so we literally had to provide funding to pay for their training because they weren't willing to spend money on something they didn't know about, and especially if they didn't think they could make any money on it right away. So we had to work with our state government to get some grants written to put this together. But the excitement that we got from the appraisers, realizing all the stuff they never knew about what is a high-performance home, the kind of information a realtor normally puts together that's inadequate for the appraiser. And also we reached out to the multiple listing services in Fargo-Moorhead. We're right on the border with Minnesota, and also with the Minneapolis-St. Paul Multiple Listing Service, and realized that both of those service organizations were not up to speed at all on green and or what the green categories are. And so we're still working with those multiple listing services to get some movement, and we have a green task force going in Fargo-Moorhead, which has representatives from the builders, realtors, appraisers, and bankers on it, as well as some of the MLS board. And we had our first task force meeting in Minneapolis to do the same thing down there. And the buzz around the, both of the communities has been pretty high. I get lots of calls from people wanting to know how they get on this committee because they see it's going to be a reality, being that these four major professions are coming to the table to do training together for the first time. And so we really feel that that is the way to approach making high-performance homes mainstream. Otherwise, we tend to be subsidizing the upper 10% to allow them to build high-performance homes for themselves, and the middle class and lower income are really not getting addressed just because there isn't enough numbers being built, because builders will only build custom homes to that level, not spec homes to that high performance level. And so that is what we have been doing in the upper Midwest here. I do feel that it takes somebody with my type of background who has a pretty good credentials in having done many, many large scale energy projects, commercial, industrial. Somebody who comes not with that pedigree will have a hard time convincing the typical builder or the typical banker that it's a reality. And so we saw that when we had our first couple sessions. We had a lot of utility people coming from three different utilities that were attending the sessions, and they told us after the meeting they don't think they would have ever been able to sponsor this without somebody with that type of a strong design engineering background that's already done a lot of projects that could demonstrate that it's feasible. So that's largely what we've done up here in North Dakota and Minnesota. I should say we've been partnering and putting on this presentation with the North Dakota Department of Commerce. And I had done a number of commercial industrial energy audit projects for the state in past years, and so they gave me a green light to dive into this type of training. We've had the utilities provide us with some funding, but in most cases only about 10 to 15% of the cost of putting on the class. And the energy grants that we've gotten through the State Department of Commerce has filled in the difference. So that's how we've come up with the funding mechanism. We are getting contacts from bankers and mortgage insurance companies and others that are seeing that this is something that's going to start to happen, and so they now want to help sponsor the classes. In Minnesota, we also got Minnesota Pollution Control to step forward, but this is after largely 2 years of pretty much one or two person trying to make an effort, make an impact into the marketplace. So we're starting to get some good success up here in the market.
Okay. I think what you're doing is extremely important. Catherine, why don't you discuss what we were talking about as far as some of the most effective policies of utilities?
Well, yeah. So anyway, just by way of introduction, I'm Catherine Johnson. I've been doing working in energy efficiency and program evaluation for over 25 years. And Sierra asked me to talk a little bit about what are some of the tips or things that issues that need to be considered when you're designing effective programs, whether they're cost effective for the requirements for a particular program filing, or in general, what are just some good best practices to consider there's a lot of good resources out there, and I want to make sure people are aware of them. I'm not wanting to reinvent wheels. I'm a strong believer in leveraging the good work that's done by other people. So I want to point out a couple different guidelines that have been available. The National Action Plan for Energy Efficiency in 2007, which was a joint collaborative funding effort put together by the Department of Energy, the EPA, and a lot of utilities around the country, came up with a checklist of sort of the best practices across the entire continuum of energy efficiency programs. And they have an awful lot of good program design advice in there. It's written more from a utility perspective than, say, a third-party implementer, but it does address a lot of the key questions. And the things that really, you know, really need to think about, it just comes down to some good common sense. Some of the most important things is, first, in order to have a good program, you really have to understand the market, which is, I believe, what Larry was talking about. He's, you know, developing some awareness of understanding the market in terms of trying to get the understanding of the value of energy efficiency improvements in the market and the value that they can actually have. There's, you know, been activities in other markets that have demonstrated, for example, I don't know if you're aware of, Larry, but in Colorado, Delta Montrose Electric Association used to run a geothermal heat pump program, and they actually was so successful that they ended up closing shop and the private industry took over. But part of the reason it was successful is because the homes that had geothermal heat pumps were able to command a higher price, and that was reflected in their appraisal price. And so the appraisers and the energy auditors in that community sort of understood the value of this particularly complex geothermal heat pump installation, and they started to translate the value of that investment into the actual value of the home. So people who had geothermal heat pumps were able to command a higher price because they could demonstrate the value of that through energy savings. So, and that's a great example of a market being transformed through understanding the market and then being able to educate the key players, which is what Larry's doing in terms of reaching out to the utilities and the program appraisers and the realtors and the builders and all the other people that are involved in a building type new construction or property type program. Another thing that happens is obviously you need to make sure you have great target marketing, and that again goes back to understanding who the customer is. For a lot of new construction programs, the correct market isn't the final customer, as we all know. It's actually the builder, whether it's a production builder or a custom builder, because most homeowners, when they look at a house, aren't thinking about energy bills. In fact, that's something that's not really even posted usually in the appraisal listing or anything. It's something they have to do a little bit of digging on. They're more interested in the aesthetics, you know, the walls and paints and the kitchen finishes and the bathrooms and things that, as my friends in the business like to say, things that don't generate a payback at all. I mean, it's just, you know, the pretty stuff. And so, again, it's important if you're doing an energy efficiency type program to try and translate the benefits in tangible terms, not just to the customer, which the builder can do very well in terms of the house will look better, it'll be more comfortable. You know, you don't sell necessarily low energy bills. You sell comfort, health, safety, cleaner environment, all those other words to make the market, you know, respond, because people in general, unless they're, you know, particularly interested in energy efficiency, and the majority of people that I've run across and customers in both commercial and residential sectors generally don't really think about energy efficiency or energy efficiency programs until their appliance fails, it's the middle of the night, they're in the middle of a thunderstorm, or they just got a really big bill. So part of the target marketing is to make the messages not necessarily what the utilities think are the good messaging, but what the customers will respond to and what the particular market will respond to. For a property manager, one of the benefits of energy efficiency improvements in a home or a rental unit is reduced maintenance, reduced operating costs. Those are things that fall directly to the bottom line, and those are things that actually can appeal to them. Obviously, you want to make sure that any kind of program you deliver has some well-defined, coordinated program delivery, whether it's coordinated through different utilities in a region or coordinated through the utility or actually through independent third parties. But it's a seamless approach. In fact, one of the trends I'm seeing in a lot of different kinds of market programs is the move towards a one-stop shop, where programs as complicated as Home Performance with Energy Star, which is a whole house energy audit that is trying to encourage customers to make fairly substantial investments through a combination of revenue and loans to upgrade their heating system and, you know, fix their insulation, do all kinds of improvements to their house. What they've tried to do now is to get it even simplified, that process. They want to simplify the application process. They want to create a one-stop shop where a customer can go in, and then the contractor who they work with can help them navigate through these through this process, whether it's helping them find a loan, helping them find sign up and receive the rebates, helping them coordinate the installation, whatever that customer participation is, trying to make it as easy as possible. And then the last thing I think I'm trying to get to, you know, maybe I just want to round up, you know, sort of just hit the highlights here, is you also really want to make sure that these programs offer some way to customers, you know, financing. That's an important new area of concern. And obviously utilities have to make sure that they're cost effective. So that's the big 30,000 foot level. I don't know how much more you want me to get into it. I don't want to monopolize the conversation here.
Well, I can jump in briefly. There are, you know, the programs such as residential PACE and commercial PACE are potential options that can bring the municipality or county or other tax increment district into the floor that, that they can add some peace of mind to the homeowner or buyer, because they would be a third party to make sure that the work was done to a quality standard as well as providing affordable financing. Those are some movements that are that can help out.
Yes, PACE programs have. There's a little bit of a checkered past with the PACE programs, and I'm sure you're.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're going on great guns, and then Fannie Mae stepped in and threw a monkey wrench into all of it, and they've had to change the approach a bit. It's certainly a viable alternative, especially in the commercial market. The concern in the residential market is, you know, the issue with the selling on the secondary market. However, you bring up the point that there are lots of different financing options out there. One that's gaining a lot of traction, it was actually started by co-ops in New England, was the pay-as-you-save model, where they're actually using, it's a performance contracting for your house. You're basically using savings from the energy bill to offset the cost of installing the equipment. And there's been several utilities around the country, both co-ops and now more investor-owned utilities, that have had a lot of success with those pay-as-you-save type programs, because they're able to then fund those much more expensive improvements and not just get away from the direct install programs. But, yeah, there's a lot of good options out there. I don't think this call will – I don't think we have the time or bandwidth to address all of them, but that's certainly good information.
Well, I found that when you can talk to a builder or a realtor that there are other options out there, just having multiple options provides a sense of comfort zone that they're not the only one charging head trying to make this work, and there's no market presence out there. So it's very critical not just to have one choice but multiple choices.
No, absolutely.
This is Michael Walton in Chattanooga, Tennessee. One of the things that we've had some success with on the sort of market side is just basically educating both realtors, appraisers, and lenders about the Appraisal Institute's Green Addendum. So that's a standard form that they can use to just basically to provide the comparative field, so that when they're producing the comps, they can adjust the value accordingly with any of the efficiency upgrades.
Yeah, that is very important. I bring that in all the training sessions, and of course we've been partnering and putting on our classes with the main author of that addendum, Sandra Adamatis out of Florida. So she has a lot of credibility when those questions come from the attendees, whether they're from the banking or appraisal or realtor market. She can talk with a lot of experience because she's consulting with 42 other states. And so it's really key having somebody who can lend that national presence when you're putting on the training. It really helps people sit up on their chairs and pay attention.
Any other comments? What are some of the things happening in your area, Michael, in that regard?
I mean, we're working on a number of the things that were mentioned. The pay-as-you-save program, specifically the structure of that being tied to the meter as an on-meter tariff rather than the residential property assessed clean energy. It seems to be a more functional tool, at least in our market.
It's on bill financing, basically. You're financing the improvements on the bill.
Yeah, but more importantly, the fact that it's tied to the meter and not the individual. So we've had on-bill finance for a while, and our utility has had some issues with that. But having it tied to the meter, especially in markets where you've got a large percentage of renters, you know, if they move out, it just stays with the meter. The next person that turns on electric at that property picks up the payments, but it also doesn't tie up the property with its, like, property assessed clean energy in terms of having that on the title.
And so you've been able to obviously get buy-in from the Public Service Commission in your state?
Our state's weird. We have TVA in Tennessee, so our the Tennessee Regulatory Authority doesn't actually regulate anybody.
Okay, and they're sort of somewhat of a unique animal. TVA.
It's a federal agency, and so they've let a couple of the co-ops experiment with the on-meter tariff for pay-as-you-save. And what we're working on now is getting them to clear it for the municipal utilities to use. We just have to come up with the financing package separately because co-ops can use USDA's ECLIP program, whereas munis don't qualify for that.
Okay. Yeah, but it's interesting to see how even a quasi-federal agency is able to create some momentum for you in a marketplace that eventually, hopefully, would be taken over by the private sector.
I'm not sure what you mean.
Well, as Catherine was mentioning in Colorado, the success of the geothermal got going so well that the private sector wanted to jump in and run it from there on as far as funding.
I see what you mean. I don't know that there's within TVA, basically all of their customers are publicly owned. There's municipal utilities and there's co-ops. But as far as the private market in each individual city, they do the work, the efficiency work. So there's sort of a relationship there where the local power company is sort of a project manager. They go in and say, this needs to be done, this needs to be done, this needs to be done. And then the owner has like a list of contractors that have qualified, and then they can use anybody on that list to get the work done.
And then does the TVA in that example, you say it helps coordinate things, but do they also provide that third party technical expertise to make sure the project will actually be viable?
So they do an energy audit and they do quality control and quality assurance after the fact, and they also monitor the electric bill.
Okay. And is electricity the prime energy that they provide, or does TVA provide natural gas?
They don't provide any natural gas.
Okay.
just electricity.
Okay. Well, that's what I've seen. I know in the Minnesota market they've had good success with commercial PACE, and the state has been behind that. That seems to be the first step that a market area will get into some form of PACE will be at the commercial level.
Yeah, we use commercial PACE here. That's been approved by the state, and that is used. There's a Pathway Lending is the organization that sort of operates that, and that has been successful for commercial projects.
Are you people also involved in trying to encourage training to those contractors?
Yeah, our organization, we provided the training for the local power company as well as local contractors. And then we are also working, so we have a demonstration development of net zero energy residential to help sort of drive demand in the market. So we've been working on that for a number of years, and we're almost done with our fourth house. But now we have a number of private developers that have sort of taken the model and run with it. So we've got, I think, 48 more homes on the books in the next 2 to 3 years.
It's taken you 3-4 years to get to that level?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we just built 4, and that project started basically 4 years ago. But it started with a design competition, and we went out and purchased land and did all that. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Are you partnering with Vermont Energy Group on that? Or what?
Partnering with Vermont? No, we're in Tennessee.
Okay. You're in Tennessee. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So your engineering expertise is within the state of Tennessee for all of this?
Sorry?
Your engineering support for designing these net zero homes is all within Tennessee?
Yeah.
Okay. Those are just some questions when you're dealing in a market and you're trying to go to that ultimate goal of zero energy. You know, where is the expertise coming from? Where is the track record? These are questions that the state or utility are trying to get an answer for before they can join onto a program.
Mm-hmm.
So does the definition of zero energy change from state to state?
No, it's actually a definition, I think, in the federal level, too.
Yeah, Department of Energy has sort of like 4 different sort of levels of net zero energy that they define. So there's like
right,
net zero, source net zero, including the embodied energy, and then I guess in another version including
or net zero ready, I guess this would be the first level. Yeah, I know Sam Raskin is really pushing hard on the net zero ready homes to be may not put solar on it right away, but once solar is on battery storage, it would meet the definition of a zero energy home.
Yeah, he's been doing that for a long time. He's been trying to promote, just raise the overall bar of energy efficiency homes in the new construction market for years. That's his mission in life, I believe.
Right, and now we see California making put their mark in the stone that by 2020 all new houses have to be net zero for construction.
Yeah, we'll see how that goes. They're having a lot of problems getting things done.
Well, I would think they would have a lot of problems, especially in the market that they're at right now. But they do have fairly high cost of energy and electricity. Michael, what is your cost of electricity in Tennessee?
We're at 10 cents in terms of residential retail. Industrial can go as low as, I think, like 6 cents.
Okay. So at those levels, solar is sort of a hard sell. Is that true or not? Or are you providing enough incentives to make it economically attractive?
No. I mean, there aren't any incentives, but it's still, you can still make it work. I mean, if you're doing new construction and you can roll it into a 30-year mortgage, it's still cash flow positive.
Oh, okay.
We have one person here who's not identified. Is that you, Evan?
Yes. I called it on Skype.
Yeah. He always ends up with a blank next to his name, so I never know for sure. Okay. Do you have any questions or comments, Evan?
I'm interested in hearing the extent to which private parties can take care of the financing, and I think it was described as pay as you save would be probably the financial arrangement. So there's no front end cost to the customer, whether it's commercial or residential, and someone else does the worrying about keeping it running and shares the savings as the profit to the company and the savings to the customer, either commercial or residential. What can you tell me about the experience of that?
Well, the pay-as-you-save model, which has been used successfully in Colorado, and actually they ran a test pilot in Hawaii among the Hawaiian Electric, which is an investor-owned utility, as well as they have had a version running for a while. I don't know, I'm not currently familiar with it, but with Energy Trust of Oregon. And the bottom line is, the key takeaway is that utilities don't like to be banks. They don't want to have to do the underwriting. They don't want to have to do the credit checks. They don't have to worry about the loan defaults, which are very, very low. So in each of those cases, with the exception of Hawaii, the utilities found third-party funding. Usually it was community banks or credit unions or those types of banks that were able to offer competitive or low interest and basically take over the management of the program from the funding point of view and let the utility do, you know, make sure the billing is taken care of. The bill is a little more complicated. In some cases, you know, they couldn't actually get the bill to match in Hawaii. They ended up sending out two bills. In other programs, I know they've had more success in integrating the billing function, but there's always a concern about what happens if they only pay a partial bill, what part goes to the financing, what part goes to the electric usage. So there's still a lot of opportunities for advancement, but the banks and the credit unions and the utilities are becoming much more adept at setting up arrangements that sort of take the worry from the utilities and put it in the people that know how to run these programs' hands. So that's my short answer to that rather complicated question. I hope I helped.
Yeah, I was not. I see the topic is supposed to be about utilities, and I was actually thinking of private parties, but there would have to be two bills because if there's an energy service provided by another one other than the utility, which I was thinking of, then obviously the billing and finances would have to be separate from the utility one, but would be based on savings in the utility bill. So I can see how that's more complicated.
Any other thoughts here? Okay. Well, we can end the call now if everybody wants. Catherine, someday I'd like to have you do this as a webinar, so we can talk about that. I know you're really busy right now.
Okay, yeah, so, later in the summer when things cool down a bit.
Yeah, you know, it's a really important topic, and I'd like to have you deal with it.
Well, this is Evan again. I did have a follow-up on what's that about Colorado, it sounded like it was the utility that did a pilot in Hawaii or another independent company. Explain that. What's the company involved?
What happened in Colorado was the utility that came up with the financing program, the pay-as-you-save program, which they had the financing run through their local credit union. The Hawaii legislature liked that idea so much they forced the KECO, which is the Hawaiian Electric Company, to develop and offer a pilot pay-as-you-save program, but required the utility to do all the funding, which then a year later the legislature changed its mind and said, never mind. So, but the short answer is, in Hawaii, it was the utility-implemented program. It's now gone through several iterations. In Colorado, the financing came from another source, not the utility's money. In Hawaii, the utility money was used.
I see.
Mm-hmm. And Catherine, motivated the finance institution to get involved in Colorado?
Well, it was the local credit union that their offices were actually in the same offices as the local co-op, utility co-op. A couple different reasons. One, they knew that the customers, they were basically picking customers based on their utility bill payment history. So they knew these customers were good bill payers for their utility bills. They didn't look at their overall credit. They looked at are they current with their utility bills. And they knew that if they could tie it back to the utility bill, it was going to get paid. So there the default historically for these programs has been very, very low. People tend to pay their utility bills. They don't necessarily pay other bills, but they do pay those bills.
Oh, okay. Good point. Yep.
The other thing that helps keep the default rate low is the nature of the on-meter tariff. So if somebody doesn't pay their electric bill, they usually have bigger problems, and they're not going to stay there for very long. So instead of in a traditional financing model, the entire balance of that loan would have to be written off and would be a loss. In this case, only that payment is written off. So the next person that moves in turns the electric service on, they pick up the bill payments. So literally, unless the house burns down, there's usually not a total loss.
Oh, yep. Well, those are good perspectives when you're having those early meetings with the utility so they can understand the benefits to them.
I'm assuming you probably already know that Boulder required landlords to do energy efficiency programs on improvements on their units, which I think is fairly uncommon. Anybody know of any other
Very
cities?
Uncommon.
What's that?
Very uncommon.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So we're actually working on a municipal ordinance around that right now, modeled after one in Memphis, Tennessee. But really what we've seen for pay-as-you-save in terms of this concept is you basically give the ability to a renter to be able to make improvements to a unit and lower their electric bills. And so from a landlord's perspective, it's like, oh, I get a free, energy upgrade, and my tenant pays for it? That sounds great.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, and that's been very successful in Kansas, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting perspective. It'd be good to have people hear more about that. Is that common throughout the country or just in a couple states?
A couple states that I'm aware of. I'm sure others know more.
Yeah, it seems to me like it would be pretty effective. It takes a lot of the reasons for the landlord to deny that happen.
Well, it also shows to that renting building owner that there's a lot of things they can do in-house just by using energy savings to fund. So I think it would something that would start to grow.
So how does that program work with the renter lead?
I'm sorry, what?
What happens if the renter leaves on that program?
So with pay-as-you-save, it's tied to the meter. So the next person that turns the electric service on picks up the payment.
Right, and in the meantime, in Kansas, what they did is the interim period, the landlord covers it, the electric bill, which is going to be minimal, and that's why they need landlord approval.
That makes sense. Okay. Anything else? Okay. Well, we can go ahead and end the call, and this will be recorded. You'll have it up online probably next week sometime towards the end of the week after the webinar. So anyhow, thanks for everybody for coming. Thanks for Catherine and Larry for giving.
Thanks very much.
Presentation. And
thank you.
See you next time. All right now.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Have a great weekend, guys.
All right. Have a nice memorial.